The Gemara in Brachas.
What is this? Is this part? Oh, jeez.
Okay, we'll wait till he comes back. The Gemara in Brachas, Daf Nun Ches, tells a story about. Oh, can I use your Gemara for a minute?
Thank you.
I'm jumping a good few months ahead of where we're up in this year. Gemara in Brachas, Daf Nun Ches, on the days, tells a story of two sages Ula and Rav Chisda were walking along together on the road, and then they reached what had been the home of Rav Chana bar Chaniloi. Now it was laying in ruin. He was a sage from a previous generation, and his home was now laying in ruin. So Rav Chisda sighed. He gave a long sigh. So Ula said, "Why are you sighing? Sighing is not a Jewish thing. We'll learn that as we get later in the Sefer. Don't sigh." So he told him, "How can I not sigh?" So this was a home. He gave a long description about the greatness of this home, which I'm not going to get into right now because the particulars are not our subject. But we're talking about a very, very great and unique home. And now look at it. It's simply a thing of the past. I'm not going to sigh. So he told him, "Look, there was a greater home that was destroyed. It's Beis HaMikdash." Rabbi Yechon said, "From the time that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, there's a gzera that homes, great homes, will be destroyed as well." But Rabbi Yechon added, that just as Hashem is going to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, Hashem is going to restore the great homes of the past. Okay, that's what we're going to begin with. Now this is interesting, because what's so important about restoring the home? The Jewish people will be redeemed, and I'm sure that the accommodations will be fine. Why is it so important to restore the actual home that you had? So here we have to realize that a very, very fundamental point is being expressed here. And that is, in Judaism, there aren't just great people, there aren't just great individuals, there are also great homes. A home, or we'll put it in another sense, just like every person is here to earn a level, right, to work in order to reach a certain level, and there will be very many different degrees of levels that people reach after a lifetime of work. It's the same with the home. A home is an entity in Judaism. It's not just a technicality. We're not just raising our kids in our home, but it's just about the kids, or it's just about my wife, or it's just about me. The home is an entity in and of itself, similar to the Beis HaMikdash. We won't say that the Beis HaMikdash was just, oh, you needed to bring the Karbana somewhere, so that was the spot. The Beis HaMikdash was an entity. It was a concept, more than just a structure. Every Jewish home is a chapter in the history of the Jewish people. And just as there are very, very great people who go down in history, there are homes that go down in history as very great homes. Now let's actually see that this is expressed in the Pasuk. Bilam said this. Bilam, by the way, is a very, very chashuv source. Bilam is one of the rare sources for Hashem's true opinion of the Jewish people. You cannot paint a picture of Hashem's opinion of the Jewish people from most nevuos. I mentioned this many times. I'll stress it again. Nevuos is the same as, can you draw a picture of the quality of the U.S. Army by hearing how the how the corporals or the captains speak to their underlings? If you're going to go by that, you know, this must be a lousy army. Look how they're yelling at them the whole time. Look how they're yelling and criticizing and yelling and criticizing. This army just can't get it straight. Right? They start talking and say, no. You want to get a picture of what the quality of the army is. Don't listen to the captains who are instructing the soldiers. Of course they're going to yell and criticize. That's how they whip the army into what it is. You have to go to some source where you're just getting an analysis of the army from the outside. Anytime it's from the inside, all you're going to hear is not good enough, failure, we want better. When you're analyzing the nevuahs that were leveled at the Jewish people, that's what you're hearing. You're hearing the captains of the Jewish people who are spurring them on to greatness. Therefore, they are not a good source for trying to get a picture of what was the quality of the Jewish people, what was Hashem's opinion of the Jewish people. Not a good source. A source for other things. It's a good source for Hashem's message to us. We want to join the privates who are being spurred on by the captains to greatness. But that's not where you get Hashem's opinion of the Jewish people. Where do you get Hashem's opinion of the Jewish people? One of the unique sources is the Nevuah of Bilam. What was most unique about Bilam's Nevuah is that it's the one parsha in the Torah, well, since Shemois, that the Jewish people were completely oblivious to at the time. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know what was happening at the time. Because it was in this parasha, Hashem wanted to give one monument to his true view of the Jewish people. In the years in the Midbar, we know the Midbar is a bunch of troublemakers. The years of the Midbar was Hashem handcrafting a nation. And therefore it was only criticism and pushing and slamming over the head and punishment. But at the end of the day, Hashem was very pleased with the results. And that was expressed in the Nevuah of Bilam, which came at the end of the 40 years in the Midbar. After all the terrible sins and all that, we have the Nevuah of Bilam. Okay, that was really in parentheses. But what does Bilam say among his Nevuahs? How great are your tents, Yaakov, your dwelling places, Israel? He doesn't say how great are your people. He says that in other places in his Nevuah. But here he is talking about the greatness of the homes. They are like extended creeks. They're like gardens growing off a river. It's like aloe planted by Hashem, like cedar planted over water. Bilam is stressing again and again, it's like things growing right near a body of water. Forget right now the poetics, but he keeps saying that again. It's like creeks, it's like a river that's growing a garden, it's like a body of water that's growing a big mighty cedar tree. What is he saying? He's saying the Kal Yisrael is full of very, very great individuals, full of giants. And the Jewish home, those are the great cedars, right? Those are the great cedars, those are the great gardens. And the Jewish home is the creek, it's the spring that nurtured that great cedar, that nurtured that great giant. The Jewish home is the breeding ground for the greatness of the Jewish people. So it's not just about a great parent raising a great child. You can't take a plant and figure that, all right, what needs to happen? There's a root supposed to start coming out of here, so I'll hold a piece of soil right here until the root starts coming out. Oh, you have to create the right environment for it to grow. So that is an entity in and of itself. It's not just about parents interacting with children, it's about the environment. It's the Beis HaMikdash. Therefore, it's not for nothing that Chazal say table is like a mizbeach. I was once in a shul, I put my hat down on the table. Someone came over to me and he told me, you should take your hat off the table. Table's like a mizbeach, you shouldn't keep your hat on a mizbeach. Okay. He was wrong. You know why? Because the tables and shuls are not like mizbeaches. It's not the table in a shul that's like a mizbeach. Table in a shul is very important. But that's not what's like a mizbeach. It's a table in your home that's like a mizbeach. Sure, it's chashivas. But the statement that a table is like a mizbeach was said about the table in your home, per se. What's the idea here? So the truth is, the idea is obvious. The idea is obvious. A home, as we said, is the breeding ground. That is the more than just the breeding ground in the Jewish family. But the home is a place where you turn it into Hashem's domain. You implement Hashem's reign. We've already discussed that the king's job in Klal Yisrael, we mentioned in the Gemara here, the king's job in Klal Yisrael was implementing Hashem's reign in the Jewish people, which was really what? It was a revelation of Hashem in all of Eretz Yisrael, which constituted a revelation of Hashem for the entire world. You, in your home, are creating a space which says Hashem Echad. Really, our job is to ultimately bring the whole world to be filled with Hashem Echad. That's what we're aiming for. Again, it's not just an issue of a bunch of people saying that Hashem Echad. It's an issue of Meloicha La'aretz Kevoidoi. Hashem's glory filling the entire world. If not the entire world, at least Eretz Yisrael. That's not in our power. We don't run the world. We don't run Eretz Yisrael. Those who do run Eretz Yisrael are doing a lousy enough job without our input. But what do we run? Our home. Our home we can turn into, again, not just an issue of raising people, but our home is already one unit, which is, can actually reach the ultimate purpose already now. You can't bring about a situation of Hashem Echad in the entire world, but you can create one block. There's already one unit of the world that can be crossed off. In my home, Hashem Echad. And therefore, also says, right? Also, Gemara and Brachas is coming up a little sooner. A wedding is comparable to rebuilding the ruins of Yerushalayim. Why? Because what's the whole point of rebuilding the ruins of Yerushalayim? It's again restoring Hashem's glory to what it was. This can be achieved in each Jewish home. And this is also what we mean when we say you're a king in your home. You're a king in your home doesn't mean that you have the right to treat everybody in your home as a doormat. Right? As the famous saying goes, if she's nothing, then you're the king over nothing. Right? But the point is, you're a king in your home, again, in the sense of implementing Malchus Shamayim. You can turn your home into a unit in which Hashem's revelation has already been achieved. Okay. Now that we've established that, let's start taking it to practical steps. And here, I might ruffle some feathers. And I'm going to enjoy doing it. I have a little bit of a provocative streak. Bear with me. Well, we'll start in a basic way. Let's start translating this into practical terms. What does this have to do with the parasha? I hope it's obvious what this has to do with the parasha. Yaakov is going off to actually build the house of Yisrael. That's what Yaakov is going off to do. Yaakov was really going to, up till now, there wasn't really a base Yisrael in the full sense, because it was all split, right? It was Esav, it was Yishma. Yaakov is now going to build the house of Klal Yisrael. So it seems a little strange. Hashem knows what he's doing. What are the circumstances in which Yaakov is going to begin implementing the purpose of the entire creation? I think Hashem would set him up well. Look, Avraham Avinu. Immense wealth, prestige, honor. Right? He was in position to build the Jewish home. How does Yaakov go off to build the Jewish home? He's a pauper. A refugee. Fugitive. Not a cent to his name. Living in an environment where they're just trying to take advantage of him. Hostile. And here he's told, go build the Jewish home. Isn't that a little strange? I'm sure Rafael Hirsch points this out. He also notes an interesting thing. At the end of last week's parasha, It says that Yaakov left Be'er-Sheva to go to Haran. At the beginning of this week's parasha, it says Yaakov left Be'er-Sheva to go to Haran. Why is it repeated? Rav Hirsch, the end of Talmud, it says Yaakov went to Padan Aram. So it already says that he left his parents' home and he went to Padan Aram. Mm-hmm. And this week's parasha opens by saying Yaakov left Be'er-Sheva and went to Haran. It's repeating. It already said in last week's parsha that he went to Padan Aram.
But where?
Haran was in Padan Aram.
Okay,
yeah. So, why is it repeated? Okay, Ramban has his pshat. Rav Hirsch says, Torah is not telling stories. The Torah is dealing with what we call a sugya. Okay, we have the sugya of Yaakov and Esav, and now we have the sugya of Yaakov going to build a home. And an important part of that sugya is that he left his parents' home and he headed for Haran. Part of the point being he was penniless, destitute, etc., etc. Why? Rav Hirsch says that a very important point is being brought out here. Hashem davka wants Yaakov to begin building the Jewish home in the most adverse of conditions, in order to stress that you know what's required to build a Jewish home? A person and his personality, and that's all. Yaakov's personality was the only requirement he needed in order to build a Jewish home. Didn't need anything else. You can build an optimal, the greatest Jewish home without a cent, in poverty, in the worst of environments, as long as you are there. As long as there's one ingredient. That ingredient is indispensable, and that ingredient is all you need. You. Well, your wife also, but that's also you. But nothing else. So there are two sides to this. As we stressed, in a sense, you don't really need anything else in order to successfully build a magnificent Jewish home. But the first side of it is, you have to realize that you are required. You have to be a part of that picture. Let's take this now to a practical level. There is no substitute for a parent. Now, everybody realizes this, obviously, right? Parent has to be involved in raising the kids. But at the end of the day, life is rigorous, right? Life has its pressures. We're all trying to bring home enough money at the end of the month. We all have all kinds of responsibilities. And there often tends to be a division between the urgent things in life and the important things in life. Work must get done, and it's got to get done now and today. And we all realize that it's important to invest time in building a solid and long-lasting relationship with your children. What does that involve? It involves playing with them. It involves spending time. It involves schmoozing. But what's time for that? When do we have time for that? It's hard to clear out the time. At the end of the day, right now, there are six pressing things on my mind that are right in front of me on the table right now, and I'm only going to manage four of them if I stay up half the night. Right? Spending time with the kids now, sitting down and reading a book, playing with them, schmoozing with them, is not urgent. Yes, I know, but it's going to wait till tomorrow too. It's not from the urgent things, it's only important. Work at the end of the day is urgent. It's also important to have money. But at the end of the day, remember that that's all it is. It's just about the upkeep of the home, right? That's all of our different responsibilities are about the upkeep. But what are you keeping up? What's the answer? I don't have an answer. I'm struggling to find the answer myself. It's a daily struggle. How do we create the time? How do you cut time out of the responsibilities? I don't know what the answer is. Let's all struggle together. But that's the point. The point is that you must realize that you can hire tutors, and you can provide your kids with all kinds of things, and just keep them off your back so that you can dedicate yourself to what you need to do. But at the end of the day, no, there's no substitute for you, as we said. You're the only really necessary ingredient to the home, but you're an indispensable ingredient. You have to be able to somehow find the time. And that's, yes, it's a big struggle. It's a big struggle. It's not an easy thing. You have to be able to test yourself here and there. Can I say off the cuff, offhand, without thinking much, what are the four top things on my kids' wish list? It's a question I'm uncomfortable asking myself. I have to be very, very straight here and say, I'm preaching what I'm striving for now. I'm preaching what I'm working on now. I'm not necessarily preaching what I practice. I'm here to express. Let's strive, all of us together, to express what we're all aiming for, what we're working for, what we're working towards. But that's one goal to set for ourselves, to be in position that I'm able to know on a regular basis. If I step into a toy store or into a candy store right now, again, I'm not getting into the consciousness of what you let your kids eat and what you don't let your kids eat, whatever it is, however you work it, you know what are the treats that they like within the framework that you do allow. If I step into a toy store now or into a candy store now, do I need to make a phone call in order to figure out what I should get? Or do I know by myself? And the answer to this is not to make sure you sit down with each kid on every Motzei Shabbos and update your list. Oh, the answer is about, spending time schmoozing. If you schmooze with your kids enough, you will know what are the things that are on their wish lists. And it's very, very important to realize that it's these things, it's the schmoozing, it's the getting down on the floor and playing, that are going to build a relationship that ultimately you will need to have in order to weather the challenges that the teenage years are going to bring. At the end of the day, all of the outside winds, and there are very many of them that we're contending with nowadays, all of those outside winds will have a very hard time overcoming a good, solid relationship between parents and child. Just, it's hard to form that relationship, and it's something, it's like it's fragile, and it's easy to lose it. You don't lose it necessarily by ruining it. You can lose it even by just letting enough time go by without paying attention. A year goes by, years go by quickly. Right? 2 years go by. You haven't had much to do with your kids. Yes, in general way, you're keeping on top of what's going on with them. You go to every other PTA, and you're on top, in a general way, you're on top of what's going on. You know enough to realize when it's time to hire a tutor, or to figure out what else needs to be done. But what's with the personal relationship? And don't think that of course my kids know. The fact that I'm spending my whole day, week, month, year, life working so hard for them, they sense that. And they realize how much love I'm just putting into them. Don't be kid by that. Don't fall into that. It isn't true. Things that are not put on the table, things that are not explicit, can't be taken for granted. You have to be making it clear to your kids all the time, I'm interested in you. I want to hear what you have to say. I love you. You've got to tell your kids this. You have to tell your kids this. It's not a given. It's not a given by kids that their parents love them. Love that, of course. Pay lip service to the concept. Of course your parents love you. But to really feel that the parents love you. I know of a very big chinuch authority who once came to a school where there were different challenges in the class. And he called in a few kids and he asked, does your father love you? You know who he was picking on. And he called in one of the kids and said, does your father love you? And the kid said, yes. He jumped. Okay. And when he stepped with the Rebbe outside afterwards, he said to the Rebbe, you heard the kid's response? And the Rebbe said, yeah. He said, yeah. He said, he screamed no. Of course every kid is going to answer yes. But if you're not making it obvious, it's not going to show. the kid will not necessarily take it for granted. Especially since we have to realize also, we're a stressed out generation. We're a stressed out generation. If I'm talking to the people my age, maybe those who are older than me will say, what are you talking about? I'm talking to the people my age. We're a stressed out generation. The stress shows at home. And you might come home nervous because of work and because of everything going on there. And your kid thinks you're upset at them. Your kids think you're annoyed with them for whatever reason. If you're not going to counter them all the time by telling them and showing them, love them, you have to be openly affectionate. There was once a father who didn't kiss his children on principle. Why? He made the mistake of reading a biography about the Chofetz Chaim. And he read the biography about the Chofetz Chaim, and the Chofetz Chaim didn't kiss his children. So this genius decided that that's a quick way to becoming a Chofetz Chaim overnight. The other aspects of the Chofetz Chaim's personality were a little more difficult to implement, but I can emulate the Chofetz Chaim in this way. I won't kiss my children. Okay. And yes, this kid started developing all kinds of, this person's children started developing all kinds of different problems here and there, etc. And he spoke with my Rebbe, and he told my Rebbe, it came out that he doesn't kiss his children. My Rebbe said, why not? The Chofetz Chaim didn't kiss his children. So my Rebbe looked at him and he said, let me ask you a question. Do you sometimes lose your temper at home? Yeah. Can't deny it. Do you think that the Chofetz Chaim lost his temper at home as often as you do? Probably not. Do you ever yell at your children unjustly? You realize afterwards that you were wrong? Yeah. Do you think Chofetz Chaim did it to the same degree? I guess not. He said, so what are you comparing? If you want to transplant pictures, transplant the whole picture. He said, I don't know if the Chofetz Chaim kissed his children or not, if it's in a biography. Maybe it's a mild indication that might have been the case, maybe it isn't. But whatever the case is, there's no doubt in my mind that if he didn't kiss his children, what that means is that one approving look of the Chofetz Chaim was enough to inject the kid with a warm feeling for the whole week. If you can do that with your kids, maybe you can consider not kissing them. But otherwise, you can't get away with that. You can't get away with that. One of the wise chinuch people of our generation says that you have to constantly be counteracting the inevitable negativity that gets into the house just because of the stresses of life and just because of the fact that you're a human. We're all humans. Today especially we see a generation of children that are blaming their parents for being human, and it's a scary thing. We would like to try to avoid that as much as we can with our children, but we are humans. What's the way to combat that? One of the wise chinuch instructors of this generation says to always try to maintain. You can be as negative as your kids with you want, as you want. You can yell at them as much as you want, but maintain an 80-20 ratio. 80% positivity to 20% negativity. If you can always be sure that you are expressing four times as much positivity as negativity, you're okay. Even if there's a lot of negative. It has to be in the same intensity though, right? Not just that, you know, you give your kid a good spanking and then you say, I love you kid, now get to your room. You haven't countered it. But think about this and note a little bit. It's not an easy thing to do, but with a little bit of attention, it can actually be something very liberating. Because I know that until I heard that, a lot of my struggles were trying to overcome the negativity. Every time again, we're human beings, every time we succumb to human nature, we lose our patience, etc., and then you eat yourself up about it afterwards, and I shouldn't have. You lost your patience, you're a human being, now make up for it. It's okay. It can be patched up. Don't come afterwards over apologetically, that's not worth anything. Right? If you just show that, oh, I'm sorry. By the way, apology, there is a place for apology. Apology in a straightforward way. But if you start buttering up the kid because you just messed up with them, that's not going to have a good effect on them. But afterwards, you keep track of your score. Afterwards, you make a point of sitting down with them and doing something good. trying to maintain an 80-20 ratio is a very, very, very good idea. Another idea, but this is more relevant for the wife than for the husband, is, this is very ambitious. You know what? I'm going to tone it down. I'll be makel a little bit. But to have a specific set of time, you have to work in a little bit of a regulator by a specific set of time that you spend with each kid. Alone. If you can do 10 minutes a day with each kid, that's great. I don't think that that's realistic for any father, unless you're unemployed. It's a good thing for mothers to aim for, even though it's a little challenging. But even if it's not that, to come up with some regular time that you're going to put in, even if it's going to be much less than that, even if it'll be 15 minutes a week, but you make a point of knowing that I spent that time alone with each kid, just focused on the kid, schmoozing with the kid, that will go a very, very long way. Now there's another point that I want to bring up, and I want to say here that I'm saying these things not on my authority. I'm saying things that I've heard from some of the greatest authorities of chinuch in today's generation. But this is something that should really be obvious to anybody who thinks about it a little bit. We often tend to confuse two concepts that can actually sometimes be mamish head-on clashes: education and chinuch. Often, a child's success in school turns into everything about his upbringing. A child's success in school turns into everything about his upbringing. Upbringing means that a kid gets a good education, he has good grades in school, he's doing well in school, he's passing his tests, etc., etc. We put all of our efforts into making sure that he's keeping up to par with the classwork, getting good marks, providing tutors wherever they're needed, etc., etc. We have to realize that that's not so. Education is one element of a child growing up. It is certainly not everything. Our main job in chinuch is to be raising children with a positive feeling about life in general, and as Jews, it's about raising children with a positive feeling about Yiddishkeit. A father can dedicate a lot of time and effort into making sure that his child davens properly, into making sure that his child is doing well in his learning, doing well in the sense of getting good marks, which has very little to do, I'm sorry to say this, I hope I'm not stepping on anybody's toes now, but the marks that a child gets in his, even his Lingvud Kodesh in elementary school, have very little to do with his ultimate spiritual success in life. Okay, nobody's throwing me out. What's that? Over, yeah. So, okay, people actually identify with what I'm saying. Sometimes people get very riled up to hear that. What do you mean? But a father can put a lot of efforts to making sure his child is davening properly, to making sure that his child is up to par in his learning, and he can be driving him away from Yiddishkeit. I'll give an example. It's certainly true when it comes to just applying pressure. Okay, let me give an example of what we're talking about. I don't know if it's good for kids to hear this. They'll quit. I'll give an example of what we're talking about. I'll just tell one story. There was a fellow who came to consult with chinuch people because he didn't understand the one area where he had invested the most efforts and the most self-sacrifice he sees working now backfiring in the worst way. Said it was very important to him that his child learn to daven properly. And therefore, he put immense efforts into his child's chinuch and davening. Okay, so the chinuch person asked him, what efforts did you do? He said, well, first of all, I make sure that my child davens with me every day, which is not easy for me. It would be easier for me to daven in an earlier minyan, to get to work on time,
This way, I daven a later minyan in order to be able to daven with my child to come to school if they're having daven. In order to be able to daven with my child, I don't have time to go home in between. I have to pack breakfast beforehand. And I daven every day with my child. Okay, how does the davening work? Well, he sits next to me. I make sure that he is paying attention, that he has his finger on the place, the siddur is open to the right page. I don't let him dream, don't let him talk. Okay. And now, the kid reached a certain age. This happens, inevitably. Kids will reach an age where you can't keep forcing them. He reached the age, he refuses to come with me to shul. In fact, most of the time he doesn't go to shul at all. Sometimes he davens in his room. Sometimes I know he's not doing that either. Okay, I spoke to the kid. The kid said, I hate nothing more than davening. All my life, davening was an oppressive, depressing thing, right? My father sat on top of me the whole time. And on top of me at any time, I looked at him, you know, it was either a pinch or it was not a pinch, and the criticism, and today you looked at him, you said it three times, etc., 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 etc. Turned davening into an experience of pressure and distress, stress, and that's really all it turned into. The father said, but the kid knows that it's not the davening. He knows that it's me. If I handled it wrong, why should the kid be rebelling against davening per se? Well, he says that it's not true. You create a certain association. For this kid grew up in an atmosphere of davening being a negative experience. And for him, davening was a negative thing. So this father, through the efforts he put into trying to train his kid to davening, was driving him away from davening. What do you do? What you want to do is not make sure the kid is performing in any area. That's not the objective. That will sometimes be a way of setting the stage for chinuch, but chinuch is not ensuring that your child performs, not in his studies, not in his davening. Chinuch is making sure that he has the right feelings about those areas that you want him to view as important. And therefore, for example, what would you do with the davening? How does it work? You have to make the kid daven, because they're not going to daven if you don't make them daven. So you have to force them. So where does chinuch come in? The answer is, it's true, you do have to force them. You have to make him come to shul even if he doesn't want to come to shul. You have to make him sit at the place even if he doesn't want to sit at the place. You have to tell him not to talk even if he doesn't want to, even if he wants to talk. But that's not chinuch. That's the first step towards chinuch. What's the chinuch? The chinuch is turning it into a positive experience. How do you do that afterwards? You force the kid to come to shul. He didn't want to come to shul. Lamaisa, he sat in shul and davened. Now, when you're going home from shul, you make a big deal about the greatness of what he just did. You come home and you announce in front of the whole family. And to see him sitting in shul and davening now was mamish a pleasure. I'll illustrate this with another little story about how this can actually be put into practice. And these are things I'm not just repeating from my Rebbeim. I'm in the process of trying to implement these things. So I can't yet say that I'm practicing what I preach. I'm conveying, because that's all I'm doing in these shiurim, conveying what I've gotten from my Rebbeim. So I'll give a story that he told. A girl was... This actually is a continuation of the story we started telling before about the father complaining about his kid that didn't want to daven. So, while he was discussing it with the fellow he was consulting with, they were in this fellow's home, a chinuch person, and mamish an opportunity arose for the chinuch person to demonstrate what he was talking about. His little girl, 5-year-old girl, came into the room with a candy in her hand. And she was about to eat it. So the machanech looked at her and he said, what about the bracha? She shrugged her shoulders and she started getting ready to shove the candy into her mouth. So he caught her hand and he said, no. You can't eat a candy without making a bracha. If you don't want to make the bracha now, I'll take the candy, I'll put it aside. You'll make the bracha when you're ready. She wanted the candy. She said, come. Okay, I'll make the bracha. She made the bracha and she ate the candy. So the mechanech turned to the fellow sitting there and he said, "What do you say about that? Was that chinuch?"
"Yep."
"No, that wasn't chinuch. What basis do I have to assume that she's going to make a bracha next time when I'm not with her?" So he said, "So what is chinuch?" He said, "And now I'm ready to be mechanech. I've done the preliminary step. The preliminary step is getting the kid to do what he needs to do. Now I'm ready to be mechanech." He called his daughter over and he said to her, "You know what you just did? So just now, you were holding a candy in your hand, and you opened your mouth to make a bracha. In Shamayim, I do a whole picturesque description. In Shamayim, Hashem was up in Shamayim with thousands of malachim around him. The thousands of malachim are praising Hashem and saying Shira. And all of a sudden, Hashem heard the voice of a little girl coming up. A little girl coming up. There's a little chavala is making her bracha. And Hashem quieted down all the malachim. Why? Because he wants to hear the bracha of his chavala. That was your bracha going up to Shammai." The girl is looking at him with wide eyes. She runs into the kitchen. She wants something else to eat. She wants to make another bracha. That's chinuch. Now, of course, you have to use creativity. You have to figure out how to apply this to all kinds of different scenarios. But the principle to remember is that chinuch is not getting your children to perform. On the contrary, sometimes, if it's not done right, and if it's not followed up with real chinuch, getting your children to perform can just be building up resistance, building up resistance, building up negativity that will ultimately backfire. Chinuch is about creating the right feelings about what they're doing. You have to put a lot of thought into this. And sometimes it will go against your efforts in having them do well in school. Sometimes you'll have to be willing to forego the good marks. You have to know where to draw the line. You'll have to know when the schoolwork is actually coming on the cheshbon of chinuch. How to differentiate. When is it turning into a negative decision? You need a lot of chokhmah there also. How to support the child in the right way without undermining the authority of the school, which can also be a very big mistake. But you have to be aware. Don't just blindly assume that a school is a chinuch institution. School is an education institution. Sometimes education coincides with chinuch, sometimes it clashes with it, and it's the parent's job to keep on top of when it's happening and to handle it in the right way. So, going back to the Jewish home, we very much focused on chinuch. That's one very fundamental aspect of the Jewish home. But coming back to the Jewish home, what you want your home to be is a home in which children grow up appreciating the beauty of Yiddishkeit. It's not just a place to come home and collapse after a hard day's work. You have to realize that the true work is when you step into your home. It's up to you, as the father, with your personality, and the mother, to imbue idealism in the home. To imbue all the time. The values that you want your children to imbibe, you have to be pumping into the air the whole time. You have to plan what you talk about at the Shabbos table. What are the things you want your children to value? This is also a very important point that's really worth a discussion on its own, but also put this into just briefly in order to present something of a complete picture here. What do you want your children to value? Whatever you want your children to value, you have to demonstrate your own value for those things yourself. Plan your Shabbos table. Shabbos table is a very, very, very great opportunity. Don't just use it as a time to relax and let your hair down. Shabbos table is a time that you have all the children around in a relaxed way for an extended amount of time. Spend time throughout the week. Three unique opportunities you have at the three Sunnahs of Shabbos. Now, this brings me to another point, which I'll just touch on briefly now, and we'll end with this. The very famous concept of personal example. Know that in order to be matzliach, in order to be successful in chinuch, you have to set a good personal example. For most of us, you know what that means? For most of us, that means forget about chinuch. Because you want your child to grow up into a great person, you have to be a great person. Right? Whatever you want your child to value, you have to live in the utmost way. Right? If you're not utilizing every moment of your time for learning, how can you expect your child to? If you ever lose your patience? How can you expect your child to go into a good temper, into a person with the midas you want? You're not perfect, yet you're trying to train your children to more perfect standards than you have. So how can the personal example be used in a practical way? The answer is that the subject of personal example, this is really what we were starting to say before, the subject of personal example does not necessarily mean what you do, that you're serving as an example of what you do, but it's basically what I said before. I preach what I strive for. That's exactly what sums up the concept of personal example. You are a personal example in what you value, in what you hold important. Yes, you'll mess up, but your children will see that you're contrite when you mess up. Your children will see what you consider important and what you're striving for, even if you're not quite there now. What your children will see you talking about enthusiastically and sincerely aiming towards it will have the desired effect, even if you're not necessarily managing to always live up to those standards. So therefore, it's very much an issue of the atmosphere you're pumping in the house. Also, in the area of personal example, it's not necessarily that you have to live exactly the model that you want your child, that embodies everything you're teaching your child. That might be above us. But you definitely have to demonstrate in your home that this is your sincere desire for yourself. This is what you're aiming for. This is what you're striving for. You have to talk about that. You have to talk about your own ambitions and spirituality. About your own values. About your own expectations of yourself. About your own struggles. When they see that you're struggling. Yes, you failed. And you describe how you felt after you failed. You describe what you want to do better next time. That's personal example. These are some, I was just beginning to address in a basic way some of the fundamental ingredients for building the Jewish home, building the Beis HaMikdash, building the Malchus of Hashem in our small units already today. Good night.